And when's the last time you saw a tag match with four men in such tremendous condition as these four, knowing when the match is over, two men are going to come out from the back with spikes and lousy haircuts, just determined to become tag team champions of the world, and they'll be fresh.
Are you ready?
Welcome everybody to Wrestling with the War!
All right, folks, you heard it right. It is back once again with Wrestling with the War. I know it's been a little bit of a layoff, folks. I've been doing some talking about modern product, but I had to get back into the war. And when you go into the war, you got to get into the trenches. And when you get into the trenches, you bring backup. You bring some buddies along with you that are ready to fight it out. So that's what I'm doing today, folks. I've got a very special guest, a first-timer to either Wrestling with the Truth or Wrestling with the War, but a good friend of the show, my main man, Bishop from Terrible Wrestling Takes. Bishop, how you doing, my friend?
I'm all right, BC. Thanks for having me. You know, if you say my name enough on your show, I am bound to show up. So I appreciate all the shout outs. And I couldn't be more thrilled to be on the show. The topics in which we're talking about, maybe not so much, but under any circumstances, if I can help out a fellow independent podcaster to put out some content, man, I love it. You put that bitch signal in the air and I show up. So thank you for challenging me so many times to come on and shout me out as much as you have. I have no problem being here, buddy.
I like it. You know, and I don't know. I'm trying to make friends here, and yet I keep making them watch 1996 WCW. And I mean, what is the thought process here? I mean, you're in for a real treat because you've decided to do two shows with us here because I asked you to watch one or the other, either Super Brawl 6 or In Your House 6. And you came to the table and watched them both. So we said, let's do it. Let's do both. So this is going to be episode one with Bishop, where we're going to be talking Super Brawl 6. And then in episode two, in a couple of weeks, we'll be talking In Your House 6. So we'll see how each of those shows compare. But before we get going on things, man, do you want to just kind of introduce yourself to the audience as far as what you do? And I know you've got a kind of like a semi-annual podcast going on right now, but
the Wrestling Takes podcast, that's my show. Go to twtakespodcast.com. You find all the platforms. There's an iHeartRadio player that streams the episodes on the website, so you don't have to even find me on your feed yet. If you don't like it, no problem. At TV Takes Podcast on Twitter, I interact daily with Terrible Wrestling Takes. I mean, that's how we got acquainted, is that you basically agree with all my takes, which is awesome. Because everyone loves an echo chamber nowadays, right? Like, we just want people to feed our own egos. But no, on the seriousness, that's just what I do. And as of late, I've been jumping on other people's podcasts. You know, the way life goes, sometimes you just got to, you know, minimize your checklist. And I knew I couldn't set out time for me to specifically task my show, because I don't do old school pay-per-views. I like to do current product and analyze the breakdown of what we see on TV, not what we think is going to happen, not what we want to happen, not what this may occur because, you know, the guy was wearing the green shirt in the front row for three shows in a row. You know what I mean? Like, it's not what I do. I don't fantasy book. What did we get on TV? How was it? So I do that. And because I can't carve that out my own time, it's so much easier for you guys to just hit me with a DM and say, hey, can you watch this dumbass show from so long ago? Yeah, actually, I can. I can put that on a Wednesday night when I'm awake at 1 o'clock in the morning, and we can record probably 2 weeks later. How's that sound? Great. Okay, I'll do it. You know, so it's easier for me to do that than it is to keep up current and really put into it. Because I like to try, and I like to give a shit, and I like to really be honest with myself and those who listen that if I can do it, I'll do it. And sometimes I put out some shit that normally requires a response or, you know, maybe some backup of opinion. And if I can't double up an episode, then I really don't want to go. So it's just kind of been like that for now. We're looking at end of September, early October of coming back into the fold, but we'll see. We'll see. Until then, you know, if you need me to watch something else, maybe I could do that too.
Yeah, I know. I remember when your last episode came out, I was like, oh my God, I'm so excited. He's back, man. It's like, I think I messaged you right away, but it was like 6 months in between episodes, but it was so cool. But I must have terrible wrestling takes too, because I think I agree with 99.9% of the stuff that you say on there. But it's funny you mentioned it, because I was going to say the same thing. It's not you don't take a fantasy booking approach to stuff. You're not like, I see so much in the social media side where people are so disappointed by something they made up in their own head instead of actually just looking at the product and understanding and enjoying it. But you get so many people that are like, oh man, LA Knight's going to win it for sure. And he's going to go on and do this. He's going to cash. And it's like, that was never in the script. So why are you getting all upset when it doesn't happen and stuff like that? So you take a logical approach to things. You look at, you know, the history of wrestling and how things are normally booked out, and you just give your opinion on it. And then you're honest as well to say if something's crap, it's what it is, right? But I mentioned in my audio podcast just yesterday, talking about like people are getting way too bent out of shape on social media about some of this stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And the whole point of me creating a podcast is I used to listen to wrestling podcasts like crazy, and everyone would say, and if you don't see it this way, you're wrong.
Right.
And that's the terrible wrestling take. The point of terrible wrestling takes is to have the conversation. It's not to say you're right or you're wrong. It's to say that we both don't know. Yep. But if we do like take what they're giving us on TV, like for instance, the Money in the Bank winners, Damian Priest and Io Sky, they had the two matches at Backlash in Puerto Rico with the biggest responses. And they were both the reason for that.
Yeah,
it's as if over the last 2 months, they've been building the two of them for this opportunity, and they've been performing that well. So why don't they deserve it? LA Knight deserve it just because everyone knows his name in the sequence in which he likes people to repeat his name.
Yeah,
that's why I loved your Cody take, because I had the same take over here. It's like, yes, Cody winning, it makes sense at WrestleMania. Mm-hmm. If he wins, it makes sense. Right. But then there's nothing else. There is nothing else. There's no reason to invest. There's no reason to watch Cody, because what's Cody going to do after that? He just beat the biggest star of the last 10 years in the biggest moment of all time. Now what? Well, yeah, I'm already tired of Cody. He grows on me a little bit, and then like it just skips back. When he said a couple weeks ago, Brock Lesnar is afraid of me. No, he's not. He's just not. Brock Lesnar's afraid of probably one person, and it might be his mom. Like, there's no one Brock Lesnar's afraid of. So it's little things. It's little things like that where just, you know, just be honest. Just have the conversation. At the end of the day, nobody knows because we don't work there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and if you look at some of the rumors on there, WWE's got to have the leakiest ship possible for all the stuff that comes out. I'm always amazed how there's so many WWE rumors that never come true, and there's zero AEW rumors that come out at all. It's just unreal. But yeah, I agree. Like, it's just take what's going on. And but speaking of LA Knight, I love the way he came off afterwards about the loss in the Money Bank. It's like, I don't need that. I've already made myself into a household name just by doing what I do. So I don't need a briefcase to do that. That's the perfect way out of that scenario where you don't have the fans turning on everybody. Because I feel bad for Damian Priest if the fans did turn on him, because it makes perfect sense for that guy to have the briefcase. The guy's a main event talent. Plus, you got a beautiful storyline going on with the Judgment Day that, you know, you got a little bit of dissension going on in the ranks there. It makes all the characters in that group intriguing. I mean, it's a great call, but people instead look at, well, my favorite guy didn't win, instead of looking at, look at what we got out of this, right?
Right. And Damian Priest winning the briefcase, it is the reason for the Judgment Day to deteriorate, because if they break them up without the briefcase, then they break them up to break them up to find a way to break them up.
Yep.
You enter the briefcase in there, and now you have Finn, who had a title match. Now you have Priest, who's guaranteed a title match. Finn, it's Priest messing up Finn's opportunity means Finn still has an opportunity. Plus, Priest has an opportunity. So it's just, it adds. And just like Cody not needing the title at WrestleMania to be a household name, like you said, LA Knight said, he doesn't need it to be a household name. My kid's 8 years old, turning 9 in August. And he loves LA Knight. He loves Cody. Guess what? Mm-hmm. Neither one of them are champion.
That's right.
He turned on Roman Reigns because Cody's more fun to watch. Like, come on. It works. It works. When they lose, it works.
Yep. Yep. You need the hard times, as I said, for old Cody. It would have been just so stupid if they had came in and just, four wins in a row over Seth or whatever. Comes back from an injury, gets the Royal Rumble win, takes the title, and then boom, by, I'd say, 2 weeks after that WrestleMania win, the fans would have been turning on him saying, we want Seth as champion or something like that. So, yeah, it just patience is a virtue with the old IWC crowd there. But we'll get off the modern product now. We'll get into our old school stuff because this, of course, is Wrestling with the War, and we're talking about the Monday Night War. So before we talk about Super Brawl, just wanted to get a feel for you now. At this stage, we're in 96, early 96 of the war going on. Were you watching live at this time? Were you following along with WCW and WWE? Yeah, and what were you? Were you a WWE guy or a WCW guy?
So at this time, I was 11. So I just turned 11 that January. And I remember watching both. It was a flip back and forth. You know, Nitro did a good job of trying to piggyback the commercials with the Nitro girls. And it was funny for me because just like my show, like, spoilers mean nothing to me. So if that's what did WCW in for me was when they spoiled Mankind's win, when they were alluding to Vince being the ministry guy. So, but I wanted to watch both. I liked watching both, and nothing was cooler than the pay-per-views being on different days. You know, they never went head to head on pay-per-view. And that's the funny thing, right? All these rating wars and all that. You don't want to go head to head pay-per-view. Good luck. You want to maximize your dollars, right? Mm-hmm. So the fact that the pay-per-views weren't head to head, I was like, awesome. I get to watch all these. I had the little illegal box back in the day, you know, statute of limitations, right? Yeah. So all the pay-per-views were free. I was watching all of them. I watched as much wrestling as I could. I had a TV in my room and everything. So I was flipping back and forth as best I could.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, I was kind of the same way. Like, so we were getting Raw up our way in Canada here, and WCW kind of came along a little bit after, but I think by 96 we were seeing it on a regular basis. But it was always Raw was first, and then they showed the replay of Nitro after Raw, so I didn't have to do the channel flipping or anything like that. But but you were seeing both shows, and you're seeing like a different product. And coming back to it now, as opposed to when I was younger, I remember I was a big WWF guy back in the day. That's what I grew up on. You know, that's all I knew from back in the day. But watching it now, I can see that I probably would have more of an appreciation for WCW if I was at this age bracket now watching it. But in the past, like, I was like, screw that. Let's go WWF stuff. And here's the old guys going over and all this stuff. And it felt a little worn at the time. But now I'm looking back and seeing WCW was putting on a pretty good product at that point. They have a unique ability to put on great shows for free on Mondays and then put a stinker of a pay-per-view up. And that seems to be the pattern with them as I'm doing these reviews, where the WWF was a bit different. They were doing kind of meh shows on the Mondays, and then the pay-per-views always seemed to deliver for them.
I agree. And even back then, as much as I can remember, because I knew I didn't pick a side. That was never my thing, was to pick a side, until it got really cool. Cause I was an Austin fan from Ringmaster. I remember Ringmaster going, oh, okay, this guy's really cool. And then when he came back and Jim Ross said he's got ice water in his veins while he was wrestling Savio Vega, I was like, oh, I'm done. This is my favorite guy of all time. Yeah. Like it just clicked for me that way. And I didn't realize until way later that he was Stunning Steve. Yeah. And when me and my brother were real young, my brother wanted to be Flying Brian, and I was the other guy. So I was even a Steve Austin fan before I knew it was, right?
Nice.
Like, so, but no, like I've never, even as a kid, like I never wanted to pick sides, because if WWF didn't have them, WCW did. So like at this stage and what we're watching, Hogan and Macho Man, they're in WCW. Yeah, I'm going to watch that.
Yeah.
But I also want to watch Owen Hart and Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels and Diesel and Razor. I want to watch all of them. Why not? So it's really funny that nowadays people want to pick sides when where their favorite guy is. My only gripe today, which we won't get into because we're not doing that show, is the production value. And like you said, it's easier to watch Nitro than it is Raw. But the pay-per-view quality of WWF is way, way far ahead of WCW. And something that WWF was doing back then that they do now that's great is their video packages and how they remind you of how this feud is important. WCW failed at it. AEW's failing at it. TNA does a decent job at recapping you during the matches, but not necessarily beforehand. So like it's an art form that WWE mastered a long time ago.
Yeah, it's funny. I just did a recent podcast with Kyle from the Apron Bump, and we did TNA from 2006. And that was something we talked about, was the quality of their video package even back then. And I think for TNA, if I'm not mistaken, they had Dave Sahadi doing them, who came from WWE. So it makes sense that's a guy that is used to that. No different than like a guy like Jeremy Borash coming over to WWE now these days and bringing what he brings to the table. So, yeah, it's a big key. And that's, you're right, that's something that AEW is missing right now, is getting the casual fan caught up on anything. Like, for me to go in and watch Forbidden Door now, I don't have a clue about any of those guys, right? And it's just another WrestleFest for me, and I'm not interested in that at that time.
It's funny because I didn't get a chance to listen to the episode you dropped today, but it is in my queue because I do subscribe.
Mm-hmm. No worries.
But I was just on Wrestling on the Rocks yesterday with my buddy Marsh, and we talked about how there's too much wrestling to watch, which was the title of your latest episode. That's one of my problems with AEW. If I turn on and it doesn't click, and I go to Twitter and say, hey, this Kenny Omega guy, this sucks, and Twitter gets at me because I don't know his ROH stuff from 20 years ago, and I don't know his New Japan stuff from 5 years ago, I'm the asshole. Mm-hmm. No, my point is that AEW is the asshole for not providing that information to me, even with his wealth of experience in AEW. Show me that video package. Put it in his entrance video. Show me why he's important, and they don't do that. That's my only thing. And honestly, this WCW pay-per-view, they kind of did the same thing where they didn't really show you why these things are important.
Yeah. Yeah, like, perfect example. We'll get into it at the end, but even something like Loch Ness. I didn't even know he was signed to the company at this point, and I'm watching every episode of Nitro. Now, I'm not watching Saturday night, so maybe that was something that was given away on that. But, I mean, if you have to go to WCW Saturday night, that's, like, say it's no different than going to AEW Dark to find out who a guy is. Like, I just don't have the time for that stuff, right? I need to know.
Or even having to watch the New Japan stuff just to feel out what it is, or the ROH stuff. And, oh, well, you should have seen this or you should have seen that. No, show it to me. Tell me.
On your main show, which is your biggest audience, you should be able to explain to people who these people are. And again, that's a complaint that over the years, especially back in this period, that people had about WWE, is they wouldn't acknowledge the past of a wrestler, but they certainly let you know what their present character was and how built up they were, right? Yeah.
Right.
All right, so we'll get into this. So we're talking Super Brawl 6 right now. So just to give people a little backstory on this, some of the main things that we're going into is the whole Randy Savage and Ric Flair feud that's happening. They've exchanged the World Heavyweight title back and forth a couple of times. Savage is the current champion going into it. Of course, Hulk Hogan is battling with the Dungeon of Doom, and it's ongoing. This has been going on for so long. My God, it's been going on for so long. He's battling the Giant in this, and you know, pretty much the mega powers are combined here, battling the Dungeon of Doom. We've got the whole Sting and Lex Luger situation going on, where they're tag champs and they're best friends, but Luger's a heel, Sting's a face, and Sting doesn't seem to notice that his friend is a heel and all this stuff. We'll get into what that looks like for a character development for Sting, and then a couple other side matches that we'll talk about. But those are the main storylines going in. The bigger storyline, I think, as well, is just the WCW, from a wrestling standpoint, is really starting to come forward and starting to take the lead in this feud at this time, because they're signing people left and right. It's amazing to see that the roster that they have right now. We're, one of the things I've commented on the last couple of episodes is we're starting to get into cocky Bischoff stage, where he's starting to really talk about how great they are. And I think that was, for me as a fan, like, I'm with you. I didn't pick sides. I was a WWF guy, but I enjoyed watching WCW and still seeing these wrestlers wrestle. The only thing I was disappointed about was losing good feuds that we had, say when a Razor and Diesel left and they go to WCW. It sucked because they were on such a roll with some of the feuds they had going on, but it was really cool because they start the NWO. But one guy that was probably the hot button for me was Eric Bischoff. And I just could not stand him. And I'm not talking like from a good heel heat. I'm talking about, the ruining of the spoilers and just his cockiness and just the way he bragged. And especially when he got into the NWO and he challenged Vince to fight. So I'm like, just shut up, man. Like, just shut up about this. It's kind of like the whole problem that people have. I hate to keep bringing it up to modern stuff, but that's the problem they have with like a Tony Khan and stuff like that. It's like, just you never mind. You're not knocking WWE off the pedestal. Just concentrate on yourself. You got some good stuff there. Just concentrate. That's kind of the guy that was the tipping point for me in that whole war.
No, I agree with you. Like I said, the only thing that made me choose a side, one was the fact that I got in early on Austin and he became, you know, to be the biggest of all time. But also, yeah, I wasn't for, like, even now, like, I'm not a dumb wrestling fan, right? Like, even then, I wasn't a dumb wrestling fan. I still get worked, believe it. I still get worked. I love not knowing if, oh, shit, did that really just happen? You know, when Natty broke her nose, when Shayna hit her in the nose, like, I thought maybe it was, like, you know, an accident on purpose. Like, there was a blood capsule so she can get a nose. Yeah. Like she had a deviated septum or something, right? No, like, it really happened. Like, there's so many different things that these wrestlers as performers can get us to believe. Like, that's the point. But when you take that investment away, then I have no reason to watch you.
Yeah.
I don't, So, like, why would I watch you then? If half of watching you is to tell me what's going to happen over there, then I'll just go over there and watch it because I like to not know.
Perfect. Yeah. Perfect example. Like, I'm with you. I let myself get work sometimes so I can just get into the storyline. That's what I want to do. Bloodline. Perfect example. I love getting worked by that. It's great. I know what's going to happen. You know what's going to happen with this stuff, but I just want to get worked by, you know, that kind of thing. You know, there's a, I'm not sure if you've ever done stuff with Bama Dave from the Bammer Slammer podcast, but he does it completely from a kayfabe perspective. He's like, I don't want spoilers. I don't want to hear your stuff that you're going to complain about this or that. I'm watching it from a kayfabe perspective. You know, he realizes that there's, you know, stuff behind the scenes, but he's not worried about that. He just wants to watch the product and judge on that. And I'm kind of half and half. I like to let myself get work sometimes because it's fun that way.
Well, I don't even watch trailers to movies that I want to see come out because I don't want to know anything. I want to be surprised by all of it.
Yeah.
You know, if I'm invested in the actor or the storyline or the saga or whatever it is, like, you know, like all the Marvel movies, I got in late to them. But by the time I was in, when I heard a new one was coming out, I didn't watch the trailer. I just went and saw it in the theater because I want to see for myself how this happens. And I wasn't a comic book kid, so I don't even know half the characters that I should know. But as I'm invested in the story and I'm seeing what's going on, like the movies make me cry. Like, that's how invested I am, because the story being told to me that I don't think I'm smarter than, that I don't seek to find out the answer, the revelations that I don't want to see in the trailers, like all being, allowing yourself to be entertained by someone else's vision. That's what this is. But trying to have that vision created in your own mind, that's what ruins the fun. And if somebody like a Bischoff gets out in front of it and goes, nah, man, don't watch it, because look, this shit happens. Well, I go, well, fuck you for spoiling it for me. Like, you're just the dick now.
Yeah. Yeah. And you just spoiled your own product for me because you're saying this is a work. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So yeah, I totally agree with that.
If he knows, real quick, if he already knows what, like you just say, if he already knows what's going to happen in WWF, then that means that somebody in WWF already knows what's going to happen at what he's doing. It's the same fucking thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Idiots, exactly. Man. So, dummies. Yeah, you're the magician that's showing how somebody else does a trick, and you're proving that your tricks are fake too.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So it never works out in that capacity.
But he has the big boys.
That's where they play. That's where they play. Yeah. But remember, anything can happen in the WWE.
It's true. It's true. It's true.
Hi, this is Stunning Steve.
And this is Delicious Dwayne.
And if you're a wrestling fan that likes to pick apart and analyze the current product,
or if you are a fan of wrestling nostalgia, also known as the territory days,
then come check out the Armchair Booking Wrestling Podcast.
We try to cover it all while giving our takes on what we would have done differently.
We're on almost every audio platform around. Just do a search for Armchair Booking Wrestling Podcast and you'll find us.
Come check us out. You won't be disappointed.
So Super Brawl 6, here we go. We're talking St. Petersburg, Florida is where we're at. And interesting number, we got 7,200 people in the audience for this. If you compare it to In Your House, which has happened in Louisville, Kentucky, they had 5,500, which was a sellout for the Louisville arena that they're at. But that's telling you something right there. WCW, I think I mentioned a couple of years ago, they were averaging about 1,500 fans for their pay-per-view. So to jump up to 7,200, you know they're doing something right at this point. And this is pre-NWO stuff. And it's also a point where the fans are kind of tired of Hogan's act. So impressive numbers for that. Yeah, so we start off with, we got the Brain, Dusty, and Tony on commentary. What'd you think of that commentary team?
You know, for Brain's only good work on commentary is with Monsoon. Cause he needs to be led, and yep. Dusty is chaos. And yes. I think Shivani was best with Tanay, and Zabisco. So it was clunky. It was clunky. The Dream tried to say so many different things. What'd he say? There's something in the area. Like, it's in the mm-hmm. area, it's in the arena. And he just, I mean, it's the nostalgia is really cool. The nostalgia is so cool. But it was terrible. The commentary sucked. They're all legends in their own right. It just didn't work together.
You're right. Monsoon and Heenan were just magic together, because Monsoon could play that character, putting him in his place. Tony Giovanni can't put the Brain in his place. Even Dusty wasn't putting him in his place. And that's Heenan's whole shtick. I mean, he's laying it out there so you can knock it out of the park on him. I mean, but there was a few times where it just seemed like Giovanni even gave up. He just was like, Heenan would say something and Giovanni's like, well, that's not what it is. You know, it's like, no, man, he's giving you a line to play off of here. It's a comedy duo thing. Heenan, to me, I still think Heenan might be the greatest all-around performer in the history of wrestling for everything that he could do. I still love there's a line during the tag team match where he talks about the Road Warriors. He said there's two men are going to come out from the back with spikes and lousy haircuts. I just think it's something like that. It's just such a simple thing, but this is what he talks about. But the boys weren't picking up what he was putting down, is the way I put it.
Yeah, there's an art form to commentary, and I explained this. I don't remember if it was on Wrestling on the Rocks or my show. It's probably on Wrestling on the Rocks, because I go on there a lot. So shouts to him at WOTR the show on Twitter, where it was like Corey Graves and Kevin Patrick's second night on Raw together. If you rewatch that and you just listen to the commentary, you listen to Corey Graves lead the table, tee up Kevin Patrick to go into commercial, tee up Kevin Patrick to start leading the table so he can do the so Corey Graves can do the analysis while filling in all the blanks. There's an art form to that. Just like with doing podcasts, there's a lead microphone like you have that can interview people. I can't do what you're doing right now. I can't do it. I have a horrible time teeing people up to get them there. But I'm really good by myself. I'll take that. And I'm really good at being teed up and going for it. So knowing your space and how to get someone else in their space is an art form to it. And that's what sucked about them. They're great in their own spaces with the right people. Yeah. But with Monsoon, because of the kayfabe, right? Let's talk about it. They're working together, right? Yes. It's not that they hate each other while they're working. They're working together to show that they hate each other. But even in the line with it was during the Diamond Dallas Page match where he's getting the $6 million is on the line. Like, they were trying to get to Bobby the Brain Heenan to say, what would you do with the money? For him to say, I would spend it on myself. For someone else to say, well, that's no surprise. And they clunked it. They clunked that whole delivery. And that's something that, because there was a wonderful, wonderful one with the Brain and Monsoon where it was Mother's Day. Happy Mother's Day. What did you do for Mother's Day? Oh, well, she took me out shopping, you know, or she bought me a car or something like that. It's like, what? We're will celebrating her being a mother. Yeah. Will you stop? But they teed each other up to work together to deliver that. And that's what these guys missed. They just didn't have it.
They didn't. They weren't quick enough for Heenan. He's just so quick, and they just weren't. And Dusty, even if Dusty is quick, he's quick on a promo, but on the announcing, he was stumbling over some things that just didn't work. I always thought an amazing announce team would have been Jim Ross and Bobby Heenan, because Ross would have been like Monsoon, able to put him in his place, he could still work off of Heenan, but then he brings a bit more seriousness to the whole thing, where you saw it with Lawler, right? I mean, Lawler was the clown prince, and here's Ross still bringing that ability to have the seriousness. I thought that would have been a good team, but
And Heenan would have give back to JR too.
Yes.
Where Lawler never really gave it back. If it didn't involve, because what Heenan was always good at, which I love, was shitting on Hogan. Hogan was always a heel to him, no matter what. When the turn happened, he goes, see, I told you, right?
Yep.
That's something that Corey Graves does. That's why people say he's trying to rip off Bobby Heenan. He's not, but that's staying in that character representation and being able to feed it back to the good guy commentary. That's something, but they didn't have that in this show. So you're right about that. I do think the two of them would be great. I actually thought you were going to say Jim Ross and Dusty. because they would be great together too, because Dusty could play the way Lawler played. You know, that's just a testament to JR being able to hold the table together like that.
Oh, yeah, for sure. All right. So, yeah. So, and I like to ask folks what their thoughts are, because there's mixed opinions on Shivani and stuff like that. But yeah, it just wasn't the right combination for this. But
yeah,
we get going right off the get go. And, you know, I'll call this show an FOH show, Friends of Hogan show, because you see a lot of those people on this lineup, right? But it's the Nasty Boys, FOH, versus Public Enemy in a street fight. And this feud kind of came out of nowhere, because the Public Enemy's pretty recent in WCW run. Ironically, I mentioned this a few shows ago, Public Enemy, the story behind this is all this is what led to that nasty beating they took from the Acolytes when they went to the WWE back in the later 90s. Public Enemy had a tryout with the WWE. They got offered a contract. They turned it down to go to WCW for more money. And that was in the memory bank for old Mr. Bradshaw and Farouk. And that's what led to their beatdown. I think it was in 98 or something like that. But
yeah.
Here we get a team. I don't know. I was never a big Nasty Boys guy. I just
you weren't young enough.
Well, I was man. Like I'm 47. So I mean, I remember when they came to AWA and started off, and I like some guys that have a bit of shape to them. You know, it's kind of like Eddie Kingston to me. I have a hard time believing that they're tough guys. But of course, Jerry Sags, he's the one guy I took as legit. Knobs just seemed kind of clownish to me, but these guys didn't do too bad. It was a typical street fight. The problem, I think, with what it was is they're competing against ECW at this time, and basically all they got was a trash can, a lid, and a table, whereas ECW would have a flaming barbed wire baseball bat at this time, right? So it's like Disney hardcore. But what were your thoughts on this match to get things going right off the get-go?
Yeah, so when I was a kid, I loved both these tag teams because they were fan centric, right? They wanted to pull the fans in. So cool. As far as technicians go, as far as tag team works go, not at all. Yeah. Public Enemy is probably one of the worst tag teams of all time. Performers of all time. They're really bad.
They look so non-legit as tough guys too, right?
Yeah. and they look non-present. Like, yes. I do. There was one of the guys, not Rocco Rock, the other one. He was always trying to get the crowd to kind of like, you know,
Johnny
put
Grunge,
their hands up. But yeah. And I don't know, but I got a soft spot for the Nasty Boys, man. It just reminds me of being a kid, that 90s punk rock, you know, splatter paint that they always use. Like, it just reminds me of my childhood. It's so cool. Yeah. But my first thought, there was a pin and then a rope break. And I'm like, why is there a rope break in a street fight?
That comes up a few times, yeah.
Yeah, and then there was pins all over the place, but they only had one referee for this tag team match. So anybody can pin at any time. And the ref was with one set while the other set was pinning in the middle of the aisle. It was a clusterfuck. Yeah. It was more fun than it probably should have been. And my MVP of the match was Rocco Rock, because he went through like six tables. So.
he did. And I mean, this is not the first fight between them involving weapons. And Sags continues to be a wild man with the tables. He'll just pick up a table and swing like a lumberjack and take somebody's head off with it. So I was impressed. You're right. It was more fun than it should have been. And it was okay. It got the crowd going for the first match. And that's one thing WCW was always good at. They always, with that opening match, got the crowd going. Unfortunately, they had trouble sustaining the crowd throughout the show, but that's typical. From there, of course, we're going to see a lot of Mean Gene in this show. And he's backstage already pitching the hotline. And I think everybody can still remember that phone number if they repeat it off by heart. But he's talked about a rumor about two top WWE stars coming to WCW. And we all know who that is. This is one where he's actually on the money. And this was a hot rumor. This is, of course, Nash and Hall that are supposed to be coming. So I'm wondering at that time, unfortunately, I never called the hotline when I was a kid, I'm wondering if he actually named them outright, because that was big news at that point.
I mean, I'm sure Dave still calls the hotline, you know? It's funny, because I was rewatching some of it today, unfortunately. I was trying to rewatch both today, but I only got through some of it. But when the number came up and it was blurred, my son goes, "What's the number?" I said, "Oh, it was 1-900-909-9900, right?"
Exactly. We all know it.
We do. No, I never called it. But yeah, that was one thing. I was like, man, I'm pretty sure Dave Meltzer still calls it, still tries to get something because it sucked. But this is another thing that sucked. You know, Hall and Nash leaving was really a bummer for me as a kid.
Yep.
And it's for what happened to Hall, period. Like, he never won the title. And that's what it felt like was going to happen, that him and Diesel were going to have some type of feud for the title. I felt it in my heart as a little 11-year-old piece of shit, thinking that was going to happen. I was like, man, I would just love to see the two. Because they never fought, you know? They never had that going. And it just seemed so logical. But, you know, c'est la vie.
Yeah. Now, one other thing I will mention about this backstage with Mean Gene, he brings Conan in, and Conan does a promo. And I thought Conan did a great job on this promo.
Awesome promo. Loved it.
Especially for a guy that we weren't familiar with. I mean, so he had to really introduce himself. And that's one thing Conan has never lacked, is the gift of gab as far as those promo skills. So that was cool to see that. His gear, maybe that's another story, but we'll talk about that in a little bit. From there, we're going to the aforementioned television title match. It's Johnny B. Badd, who's the champion, versus DDP for the TV title, as well as the remaining $6.6 million of Kimberly's money that she won at a bingo game, I believe, was how she won it. So right off the get-go, we have Johnny B. Badd's entrance. And I should mention, by the way, this is one of the last matches for Johnny before he leaves for WWF, because he wasn't happy doing this angle, having Kimberly as his manager. Obviously, he's a married man. He has Sable as his wife, and he just wasn't too cool on it. I really felt this match that the focus was more on DDP, and the focus was on Kimberly as well. And I don't know about you, but I know everybody loves Kimberly Page, especially after the whole 40-year-old virgin scene that she did and stuff like that. But I found her so unbearable in this. Like, she was stealing camera time like crazy from old Johnny. When she talks into the camera, I find her just kind of annoying. I don't know. I never was a big Kimberly Page fan, but for obvious reasons, I know people are very big Kimberly Page fans. But what were your thoughts on Kimberly, especially during this match?
Loved it, which is funny. We start off the show saying how much we agree, and so far, not so much. But no, I wrote down, Kimberly is beautiful and gets the camera, because there's so many people that don't understand what the camera's for. I get what you're saying, though, because in a wrestling form, the story they're trying to tell, it should be within them. But it bugged me to go, this didn't turn into anything for Kimberly, right? Like, an opportunity to make a star in a woman. I know that wasn't happening in 96, but my 2023 hat looks at her and goes, oh, my God, like, she is absolutely gorgeous. So stunning. She's athletic as fuck, because she was one of the original Nitro girls too, right?
She started them, yeah.
Yeah, so like, and she has the camera presence, so she gets that whole, they could have done so many things with her. Now, she was also in an incredible issue of a magazine with the blessing of DDP being in there as well, which I thought was a pretty cool touch. But all in all, though, no, I thought she was great. And to your point, though, in the wrestling format, she didn't add to the match.
Yeah, like I use the example of the entrance. It felt like she had about 3 minutes of entrance time while Johnny's just standing there waiting to toss his frisbees around. And maybe, you know what, maybe this was a semi-burial of him because they knew he was going to WWF or something, or because he was complaining behind the scenes. I agree with you.
Or he checked out.
Yeah. Well, in this match, it didn't look like that he checked out or anything like
that.
Yeah,
that's true.
But I agree, that run that she did with DDP when she was managing him is in more of a heelish way. I like that run for her. I guess the goody two-shoe things, which is the same as what was happening with Hogan, was just not coming off at this point, as we're starting to get a little bit darker in the mid-90s. So maybe that's where it was kind of rubbed me the wrong way. But yes, she's a beautiful lady. She's really athletic. They could have done so much more with her, that's for sure. And I think her just being a heel manager of Paige would have been really good, the more serious Paige that we got. Now, speaking of Paige, I continue to be impressed with Diamond Dallas Paige. When you think about the fact the guy just started wrestling at 35, he was a manager prior to that, which I remember him from his AWA days, and I loved him as a manager back then with Bad Company, and he had the Diamond Dolls and stuff like that. It was really cool, but I remember watching that thinking, man, he towers over his wrestlers. This dude should be in the ring himself, right? And And but his progress in these matches, like, he's coming up with moves that you haven't seen before. You can tell that he's putting the work in to get his body in good shape. He's great. Talk about a guy who eats up the camera time. He was great for that. Great promo, stuff like that. And, me and Jay used to talk about when we started doing this, he was like a box of gimmicks when he first started, but you keep seeing him get rid of some of those gimmicks and just become Diamond Dallas Page. And I thought he was probably the most improved wrestler of 95, 96.
Yeah, he was a reason actually that I would watch WCW. He was one of the guys like Austin on WWF that made me watch. When you're watching for the title, like, that's the reason you watch the show, but there's an extra hour and a half that you have to watch. You look for something to grab onto. Yeah. And WWF to me always had more than that, but I always found new people. And, Billy Kidman, Disco Inferno, DDP, those are just a couple guys that Alex Wright, I thought was awesome. Like, there was so many guys that they put out in front of you that's like, oh, well, maybe I'll watch next week for these guys and see what they do.
Funny you bring up Disco.
Yeah, like, I know a lot of people hate him, but
no. To this day, he's probably the most misunderstood wrestler in the history of the business. They don't get what his character was supposed to do and how good he was at his character.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Like, when you, and that's fucking wrestling community. I hate them. They bother me so much because what is the point? The point is to get the audience to react. So if they're forcing you someone and you're booing because you think they're forcing you, guess what? You're doing what they want you to do. So if Disco comes out and he tries to get the energy going on, great. And if he does it so much to be so fucking annoying, guess what? He's doing his job. So that's, but I always found him to be, like, again, a name like Disco Inferno, it's iconic because it was iconic beforehand. So you're now in the ethos. But he also looked like Vinny Del Negro when he was on the Spurs. So it was like, oh, this, I had to figure it out. I was like, wait, did Del Negro start wrestling? Are they related? And there was no internet back then. So we'll never know.
That is a throwback comment if there ever was. I love it.
I was watching.
Just to finish up this match. I mean, I thought it was a good match. Both guys are talented. Johnny B. Badd always puts on a great performance. The guy was skilled. Yeah. It's so funny. Like, there was an initial push with the Wild Man character in WWF, but unfortunately the whole Sable thing just kind of put him to the sideline. But the guy was talented. It's kind of interesting. It would have been interesting to see if he had brought this whole Johnny B. Badd character to WWF, how well he would have done. But overall, your thoughts on the match itself?
It was good. Yeah, it was fun. Yeah. It was good stuff. I just wrote down good stuff, bad ref counts.
Yes.
The ref work was really tough, but it didn't take away from the performances because when the ref counts three, that's the one that matters. But the other ones, they were really bad.
Yeah. And I mean, isn't it nice to see finishers that actually finish people too?
It's great. It's great. That's why I love Gunther. He doesn't even use a finisher and he finishes the match. That's why I love him.
It's great. Yeah. All right. We're backstage again with Mean Gene and he's there with Harlem Heat. And I thought once again, great promo work from Harlem Heat. Even Stevie Ray had a really good promo and he's not, at this time, known as the promo guy. Now, as he's grown older and stuff, he obviously became better at it. But both of them were intense. Booker sounded tough. I thought that was good.
Yeah, you can see the immaturity in Booker T as far as, like, wrestling age goes. Stevie Ray did it a little bit longer, so you can see that the maturation in Stevie Ray where Booker T's kind of getting there. And it segues into the match from there, no?
Yeah, we got Harlem Heat versus Lex and Sting. And, of course, Sting and Lex are the champs. This is for the tag team titles. And the winners then must face the Road Warriors later on based on things that happened on Monday Nitro where Harlem Heat interfered in a match with the Road Warriors and started this whole three-way schmoz. But it's good. You got some storyline going with the tag titles.
Yeah, and better to have two matches in one night than a gratuitous triple threat, right?
Yes, it was actually a much better way to do it. There's some intrigue to what's going to happen. So, of course, the storyline being that Luger is Sting's friend, but not doing his part as far as pulling his weight on the team, taking the cheap way out. He's cheated a few times. Of course, they won the titles by him using a roll of silver dollars in and hitting, knocking out, I think it was Stevie Ray at the time to win the titles. Of course, Sting somehow doesn't realize that there's silver dollars rolling around the ring, and yet they're tag team champions. So Sting, not looking the brightest guy in here, but once you put that all aside, I remember I was watching this. My wife was in the room as well. And I said, come over here and look at this. The smallest guy in this ring is probably Sting at 6'3" and 255 of solid muscle. And look at these guys move and compare it to what we're seeing right now on TV. This is just mind blowing how fast these guys were, how jacked they were, how good they were. And you could, this is where you're starting to see Booker T is going to be a star in the business as well.
Well, yeah, I think that's something, another thing that we kind of disagree on. I felt like in the match, there was no real display of talent. They were so focused on the, well, so you mentioned Kyle's name earlier, and I did a pay-per-view with him, a couple years back, and it was, I think it was Harlem Heat versus the Nasty Boys. And I remember seeing so much more out of Harlem Heat during that match. And they, because it felt like in this, the camera focus and the commentary was so much on Sting and Luger than anything to show you with Harlem Heat. I think that's what I was getting at. But no, you're right about the athleticism. Yeah. These guys are massive. I think Luger, this is some of his best work. Because it was. Because character-wise, he allowed that character to consume his wrestling. Because he's not a good wrestler. Yeah. But when his character matches his in-ring work, that's the job, right? So, and even in the later on, I have more to say about that same thing. Like, so yeah, I thought we could have seen more athleticism, more cohesiveness from Harlem Heat, but there was so much focus on the Sting Luger story that I was a little disappointed with this match.
Yeah. Okay. So that, I will agree with you on that. Their job in this match was just to be there for the ending that's going to happen with the Road Warriors. And there was a lot of just basic heel tactics for it. And the announcers were just so over the top with the whole Sting Luger thing and what's Luger doing, that kind of thing. I'll agree with you. Luger's late 95 to mid 97 is probably the best work of his career. He was on fire during that time. And I really liked that character for him. But yeah, just, I'm talking about like more of the little things, this, and just seeing how smooth Booker T is and doing his spinneroonies and his moves off the top and stuff like that, and his axe kicks that look like they're taking the head off a guy. But yeah, in the end, they were fodder for what's happening with the storyline with the Warriors.
Here's something that you never realize until you see a match like this. Steve Austin on his podcast used to say that 20 by 20 squared circle. I believe WCW uses a 16 by 16. With big guys like this, that ring shrinks, man. But it's a testament too to actual tag team wrestling. Like when you look at a tag team match in WWE now with that 20 by 20 ring, there's a lot of room to play to cut off the other half of the ring, right? You can do so many different things in so many different spaces. When you cut off half the ring in WCW and you to not allow that tag, you got to do some work in your corner. So there is a lot to show there too. So there's some minutia there. I just felt a little overwhelmed with the story to not enjoy the match, maybe as much as I should have.
I agree with you on that count. Yeah, for sure. That's a great take on that. It's a great wrestling take, I'll say.
It's what I do.
Yeah, I'll tell you, man. There's nothing better than a really well done tag team match. Like watching stuff like the Midnight Express against the Rock and Roll Express from the 80s. It's beautiful to watch. Just cutting the ring off and stuff like you talked about. And yeah, in a 16 by 16 ring, that's tough when you got four guys who are over 6 feet tall and can reach across the ring and grab hold of a tag.
Right.
The one thing I did find about the Sting Luger thing, I liked them as tag team, but just felt like two individual guys that should have had solo matches against the tag team in this situation. Right. And that's, I always like my tag teams to feel like an actual tag team, but it's a missing art form these days. I wish there was a bit more focus on that. As much as FDR talks about it being great, they're still not the Midnight Express at this point.
Yeah, that's what made the Usos and New Day so special to me when I got back into wrestling, is that when it was done well, it was stealing shows.
Yeah, agree. All right, so in the end, we get the Road Warriors come out, the cost Harlem Heat the victory when Animal hits Stevie Ray with a piece of metal. This is the throwback to the Nitro episode where the same thing happened to Animal for the loss. So in the end, it's fodder for it. And we're going to have the Road Warriors against Sting and Luger later on. They were selling through the whole thing that, oh man, like this team, whoever wins, it's going to be just devastated for that match against the Warriors. But then right off the bat, we go up to the ramp with Mean Gene again, and Luger and Sting are going up the ramp, and it seems like they're pretty fine from after a brutal match against Harlem Heat. They seem energized, they seem good. Luger's all pumped up, so you know, we forgot a little bit about selling at that point.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess all that Ico Pro back then will really do that for you, right?
And of course, Sting is oblivious to Luger's tactics as well, once again.
It's really weird, too, because when you said it's the individual guys, right, then you can say, well, the friendship can get them, you know, that unspoken bond, right? Like, not necessarily tag team partners, but we've known each other forever. So, yeah, we can be good at this.
Yeah.
But I hear you on that. And that's what I was kind of wondering, because even in, when we get to the LOD part of it, like Sting's ability to give more of a shit about Luger than the tag titles, but also care about him because of tag titles, it really does Sting a disservice.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. All right. From there, after Mean Gene, we get our U.S. title match. It's One Man Gang, the former champion, against Conan, who's the current champion. And as we mentioned, Conan had that great promo earlier in the show. So it's more of a slimmed down version of the One Man Gang compared to his Akeem days. He's obviously still tipping the scales over 400, but he looks a bit more svelte. Maybe it's the black outfit or something like that.
There's a couple layers of Spanx on.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Conan with an interesting choice for his gear. I know it works well down in AAA and the Lucha Libre stuff, but it was interesting gear when you're watching him here. And I certainly enjoyed Vato Conan that comes in later on more so than this. But what are your thoughts on this car crash of a match here?
You know, and to my point about Harlem Heat, I thought this was a Conan display. Like, we really got to see Conan's performance. There's some disservice. We didn't talk about it in the Nasty Boy match of the camera angles, especially when people fall downstairs, because that happened in this match too. Yeah. But no, I thought it was a fun display of Conan. Got to see him a younger version, quicker.
Jacked.
Yeah, he looked awesome. And I think it wasn't necessarily the Conan we got later on, but it was a good version to see, and really good. He was really good. One Man Gang. I mean, this is one of those things where, you know, when Kane would come back and they're like, oh, why is Kane here? Do it. Like, this is part of the business, right? This is the older guy helping the younger guy look better. Mm-hmm. He did his part at helping Conan look better. He just didn't look good himself.
Yeah. And I would say my comment was it got very slow when OMG was on offense. And then when Conan got on offense, it picked up. There was a couple of botches during it, but I think that's just more so a styles clash, you know. Gang isn't used to the whole Lucha Libre style. So we're not talking about a guy who's, you know, 200 pounds trying to adjust to this. We're talking about a big man where there's some tough moves that he's got to get used to. But overall, Conan was the guy that they were focusing on, which is the point. You don't need to see One Man Gang look like a beast.
Did he beat One Man Gang for the title?
Yes, he did.
Did you see that match?
Yes, yeah.
Was that any indifferent to this one or similar?
Pretty similar, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Again, just looking to make Conan the star.
That might have been their only two matches. They may not even have gone to the power plant or, you know, anything beforehand. It might have just been the only two times they tried doing it, and this is what they got. So
for sure.
No sweat.
I mean, Gang's got some miles on him too. I mean, the guy had been around since the late 70s, right? So yeah, it was fine for what it was. All right, back to Gene backstage, and this time, once again, he's pumping the whole 1-900 number and the Hall Nash rumor. They're really all over this, which is interesting because this is February when this is done, and we don't have those guys end up in the show till late May, so we knew this was coming for a little while. As fans, we didn't know who he was talking about, but man, big news here. And then we get the Road Warriors in for a promo. It's a typical Road Warriors promo. A lot of screaming, a lot of yelling, but still scares the living shit out of you. So that's what they do, man. It's still the Road Warriors. I'm still to this day surprised not one announcer lost an eye with those spikes on their pads when they're doing the promo.
The most intense not joke of all time, right? It's like, our dearest, sincerest apologies. Not... Man, they're so sauced up, man. Those guys are – they're massive jacked. Again, as kids – and, you know, my older brother, we're 18 months apart. So anytime there was a tag team, he was the skinny guy. I was the fat guy. So I was an animal guy through and through. Mm-hmm. You know, with the Nasty Boys, he had black hair, I had red hair, so I was Knobs, he was Sags. Like, we always found these delineations in who was who when it came to these tag teams. So I loved them all as a kid. That's why I love tag team wrestling now. Like,
yes,
you know, it really gets you there. And LOD, the Road Warriors, whatever incarnation they were just the best. They
were awesome,
the best.
Yeah.
They weren't. I mean, I'll tell you, look, I'll say this, and I don't fucking care who you call it, Terrible Wrestling Take if you want. They weren't good wrestlers.
No.
But they were outstanding performers. They they did the job. They sports entertained their ass off.
They were the Hogan of the tag team division. And
1,000%.
And that's not an insult. That means they made a ton of money and they were believable for what they needed to do. So yeah, it worked for them. So before we get to that Road Warriors match, we have one of the most iconic moments in wrestling history. We have I Respect You strap match between the Taskmaster and Brian Pillman. And man, this is a moment that still gets talked about to this day. It stayed kayfabe for the longest time. I think it was only in the last few years that Kevin Sullivan came out and really laid down the story of what truly happened in this situation. But people, you know, were wondering what's the truth behind this. But I'll tell you, man, Brian Pillman did such a great job of playing this unhinged character, and this whole scenario with Sullivan looked so real, so real. Like their fight, their matches looked like truly like fights. And I think it was Shivani said in this one. Well, I'll say this. So it was basically a minute and a half of just whipping by Pillman, and then Sullivan finally gets the strap and gets the advantage, and right away Pillman grabs the microphone. Says, "I respect you, Booker man," which of course was a big deal because nobody knew what the hell a Booker man was. But obviously that was behind the scenes inside baseball, revealing that Kevin Sullivan's the guy that's booking these matches. And then he hightails it out of there. And actually Pillman ends up getting fired by Eric Bischoff the next day. And a week later, he's on ECW television threatening to whip out his Johnson and then urinate all over the ring. So this guy was just insane, and I loved every minute of it. So the story behind it is that Sullivan revealed they were working everybody. Him and Pillman came up with this angle. Pillman came to him and he liked it. They didn't tell a soul about what was going on, and they just worked it. That they're, you know, that Pillman's lost his mind. He's gone off the edge. Bischoff says that he knew about it and that there's a whole agreement that, you know, we're going to fire him and then he's going to come back after a little moment in ECW and they're going to make $1 million with him, and doesn't happen. He ends up going to WWF shortly after that. So all interesting stuff. But what do you think about this whole situation? What are your memories of the whole Pillman situation back then?
Yeah, I remember Pillman like just being awesome, right? Like, So I gravitated to him. I don't necessarily remember this specific moment. I do in the ethos of time, yes, but not when I was 11. So,
yeah.
And then I only heard the Bischoff story of it, how he worked it to get fired. So they had to terminate his contract, and that it was all this ploy just to, so anyone, like, it had to be legit, Let's do it legit. You know? And then of course he basically worked everyone to get WWE money, which is so awesome.
Yeah.
And the fact that they're willing to admit that now, but no, I thought, it's weird, man. It's weird when wrestling doesn't go the right way. So When it came off this way, I was like, oh, what? Respect to Kevin Sullivan for what you do for the business or have done for the business, but fuck, he sucks. Like, he's just bad. He's just bad. Like, it doesn't look good. You know, when you and Hogan have the same haircut, but you're literally like half his size and twice as wide, like, and wear yellow trunks too, like, you're not doing yourself any favors. So like, it's hard to like really care. And then when you find out that like, he was a big reason for writing stuff. So you give him some credit for stuff you love, some credit for, you know, or some blame for the shit you don't, and to write your own story and it suck. It's like, come on, man. So all in all, my kid picked up the fact that, you know, Pillman flipped off the crowd on his way out. So that's part of being unhinged too. You know, we lost Pillman too soon. I guess that's my main takeaway, is that he had a mind for the business that, you know, other people didn't think on that level.
Yeah. I myself was a Pillman fan from day one, because I used to get Stampede Wrestling up here watching it. And so I remember when he was a rookie in Stampede Wrestling in the 80s, teaming with Bruce Hart. They had a tag team back in the day. And then when he went to WCW, I thought he was just a cool character as Flying Brian. And then, of course, the Hollywood Blondes was just so good. I loved him and Austin together as the Hollywood Blondes. Austin always talks about being probably his favorite time wrestling was when he was with Pillman. And then this unhinged character was done so well. It's just, I just thought he was just nuts at the time, like just absolutely nuts. There was a points where I didn't know if this was real, if it was fake, what was going on. I remember when this angle happened again, it felt like it was real. It felt like they went off script with this whole situation. Sullivan, you know, even selling the ring confusion as what the hell's going on. But of course, he was also giving the referee cues too, because referee, now I notice it now versus I wouldn't even notice back then, he's getting the strap ready for Arn to come in the ring. So Sullivan obviously gave him the tip off that there's going to be another match happening here. But I feel bad that I hear what you say about Sullivan. I feel bad that this is unfortunately part of his career that people look back on, where it was such a joke with the Dungeon of Doom and all this stuff, because he was such a great heel back in the day in Florida wrestling and stuff like that. And he learned from Eddie Graham, and he's great mind for the business. And even if you listen to him on shoot interviews now, he's got such a great mind for the business and stuff. Kevin Nash loved the guy. They used to have great conversations about things. His whole comment was talking about after Tyson got signed by the WWF, he's like, he sees Nash in the hallway and he talks about how they just hit the iceberg and they're going, this is in 98. This is in April 98. He knows it's done. They just got Tyson. So he's a smart guy, but this was unfortunately a run that's not memorable for him. And then after this whole situation, you have Arn coming in, who looks like he's dressed for Sunday golf or something like that, in his khaki shorts and his long sleeve polo. And they have a little bit of a throwaway match with the strap. And then you got Flair coming in and trying to reunite them, because they're going to be the alliance against Hulkamania, which is, if you think this show's bad, wait till Uncensored. It gets even worse. But yeah, just a whole dog's breakfast, as I like to say, for this stuff. But the unhinged Pillman character, that's what we got out of it. It's just amazing what he did to pull the wool over everybody's eyes.
Yeah, I wasn't a fan. Even the Arn stuff, I was like, this doesn't make sense. And then Flair coming out and trying to create some promo to make sense didn't make sense. It was really tough. And maybe, you know, I'll walk back on the Taskmaster a little bit there and give you the credit for what you said. I'll do a little bit more homework and maybe download an interview with him, you know, kind of speaking his mind, and I'll gain a newfound respect for him for sure. But yeah, it wasn't good, man. It wasn't good. Nothing that I saw. And I'm jaded. I'm jaded on a lot of wrestlers. Like, I'm not I don't give Flair the respect anyone else does. I never saw good stuff that I invested in from Ric Flair, because all of that was before I started watching. He had like some hits, like talking like with Macho Man at WrestleMania on, like some. But he got another three title runs after that I don't fucking remember anything fun of, you know, like it just, so, I mean, but that's just me as a kid watching. And then, so like all his good stuff's behind at this moment, just like Taskmaster, all his good stuff's behind. I don't revere him as anything good, but that's on me for being young and not going back, you know?
You know what though? But if I'm an 11-year-old, you watching the Taskmaster and the Dungeon of Doom and Ric Flair at this point, I'm like, what is this garbage? Even at 11, because the Dungeon of Doom was such a joke, and they get made to look ridiculous at the end of this show. Yeah. But yeah. And even Flair was so unhinged at this point. And I mean, there's so many nuances of this. They're basically trying to say Flair is going absolutely insane because of Hulk Hogan, but really it wasn't, you weren't reminded of that enough to understand why Flair was so unhinged. And like this promo that he tried to pull off was bad, because he didn't even give Arn or Sullivan a chance to talk. Arn had to literally grab the microphone out of Flair's hand to try to get some semblance of order into what's happening here. Cause I think what they wanted to get to is them saying they respected each other and let's get realigned here. But Flair just kind of was going off. So yeah, I get where you're coming from. And if this is the only experience people have of Kevin Sullivan, holy crap, man, it's not good. But his Florida stuff was fantastic. But yeah, there we go. So backstage, once again, we got Gene in the back with the Giant and Jimmy Hart. And I wrote down something, something, Hogan is a dead man. That's
what I wrote. Yeah. I said Giant promo, typical 90s trash.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. That was about all I got. Yeah. And then my next comment was, we're only halfway through the show.
I know. I know. Yeah. I'll try to speed this review up too. Here, yeah.
Well, it was the content that they put, the segments they put in. It was match, yeah. Gene, match, Gene, match, Gene, match, Gene. It was just so much. They fed you so much to eat in the beginning. It slowed down a lot at the end, which is good to be able to watch some matches. But the matches that they gave you afterwards was, again, ugh.
Mean Gene.
Thanks,
and
BC. Thank you.
Mean Gene and Jimmy Hart were the hardest working men in WCW. They were on screen 90% of the time.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. All right. After that great promo by the Giant, we get the Road Warriors against Luger and Sting once again for the tag team titles. Lex Luger, probably to start this off, went to the Larry Zbysko School of Stalling because he took about 20 minutes to get into the ring because he was so scared of the Road Warriors. We're talking Lex Luger, you know, former world champion, is scared to death of the Road Warriors at this point. But, you know, it was your typical match. It 10 years prior to this would have been absolutely amazing to watch Luger and Sting against the Road Warriors in 96. Not the same. You got the nostalgia from it, is what you got. But again, we could see what was going to happen with this match. We knew the Warriors weren't winning the titles in this because they still had the Luger Sting story to tell. But and then you get a double count out to end it. Thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, it's always disappointing when a match doesn't go the way that, you know, the gut tells you. You know, what are we getting here? And, you know, I had overall, it was still the Luger heel story. You know, everyone being a pawn in that, it just kind of sucks. I thought it was a lot sloppy. It was just a brawl. This is where I was alluding to earlier, where Luger's character performance with the in-ring, I hated the on-the-ramp stuff, but when he got to the ring, and even when the fresh guy would get tagged in, Luger would back up like, no, don't tag me in. He's too fresh, you know? Yeah. Or when he's working on, Sting was working on Animal, Luger gets tagged in, they switch, Animal stands up a little too quick, and he's like, whoa, I'm not ready for this. Like, that character work is awesome. That's the
nuance.
Stuff where,
we call it the nuance. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. That nuance is amazing, and it's stuff that a lot of people don't do.
Yeah.
So being able to see that and feel that's the story, cool. No payoff in the match for that story. That's what kind of sucked. And the double count out's always stupid because then we just had two tag team matches for nothing.
Yeah. You could have got away with all this wrapped into one match, either against Harlem Heat or against the Road Warriors. You didn't need both matches for this. And I agree, the nuance after he did the ramp thing, like I liked even like when he finally was ready to get up on the apron, two times he hesitated and came back down, and then finally the third time he went up. And I agree on that spot where Animal, where he gets tagged in, and Luger comes charging in because the Animal's down, and all of a sudden Animal pops up, and he's like, whoa, no thank you,
great.
Sir. Yeah, that was good. And you don't see that. You don't see as much of that anymore. But overall, just a double count out is you know, kissing your sister type of thing. It's not fun in it. When you have two tag team title matches, you expect the titles to at least drop to somebody.
Right.
All right. And guess who we're going back to once again? Mean Gene backstage with Ric Flair and Woman. And this was a typical Flair promo. It's good stuff. He always can pull off a good promo. Gene, I felt, was on super pervert mode as he's the one that actually brings up Space Mountain trying to get a rise out of Flair to make a comment about Woman. And then just his leering, as I say, at Woman was off-putting. It's like, I mean, Gene, calm her down, buddy. You know, it's you're a married man, you're 60, let's take it easy on our dear friend Woman here. But
I thought the promo itself, and again, this is something about Flair that, like, it was character work, it was screaming, but it had nothing to do with the match, it had nothing to do with the story. And that's why I'm always bummed out. Like, his most famous promo, you know, that a lot of people repeat, is about his character. which I get it. Like, there's a reason to hate you. But when it comes to who you're facing, if you're just the person that's hated, doesn't matter who you're facing, well, then I don't need to watch you because I hate you already. You know what I mean? Yeah. So, like, not getting the story work. And he was in a big story.
Yeah.
So even when Gene was trying to feed him the lines about Elizabeth and whatnot, like, it wasn't going there. So I was really bummed out with that. I thought Woman did a good job on camera as well. And she has a lot to do later on as in WCW too. So yeah, she was always a good character. And that's something that I guess they were teaching really well, was how to perform as not a wrestler in WCW, if that makes sense. So, but yeah, like you said, Mean Gene was all over the place. So
yeah, I was on a Will Gray show, Botch Spots, and we were talking top 10 managers, and I put Woman in that conversation because she doesn't have to say a word and she just captures the camera. She'll just stare into that camera and you're just like, you're mesmerized by her. You have to watch her instead of what's going on. She doesn't have to say a word. So, and she did that here too. So comparing her and Elizabeth, there's such a big difference between the two of them. And I don't know, I was more of a Woman fan than Elizabeth, to be honest with you. The damsel in distress was kind of done by this point.
Well, and Elizabeth did so much without saying anything that you had to just like her to like her, which is, I mean, I did. So, but to your point, like, as a performer, Liz was damsel in distress, or I said I won't say the bad ones, so I won't. She was a really bad lady, you know, yes. Like she was either the damsel in distress or a really bad lady.
Yeah.
So you can fill in the blank in a bishop term as you want. But no, yeah, it's just, you know, yeah, I hear you on that. I wouldn't put Liz high on my valet or manager status because she wasn't that. But yeah, she's an icon for who she was, for sure. It's just there's nuance in wrestling and there's reasons to gravitate, you know.
It's the whole thing. Like 10 years ago, it worked perfect with Savage. It was fantastic. The damsel in distress was perfect for his character. In 96, with, you know, with what's going on, it just wasn't the same at that point. You know.
Well, even Randy in his promos talking about Liz was being the, you know, the way I felt like that 10% that the macho man who was 90% needed to keep him whole. And this is how he keeps his mental focus, which was, you know, cool about how this match ended. But, you know, yeah, yeah, I hear you.
Yeah, and that's the whole reason. Also, we had both the Flair promo and the Savage promo because they were getting the ring set up with the steel cage because we're gonna have back to back steel cage matches. Like, there's booking 101 right there for you. Is back to back steel cage matches, and by the way, each match has a different style to it. So Savage and Flair is gonna be pinfall, or you know, and then Hogan Giant's escape from the cage because it's Hogan, right? You know, so right, that's the way it goes. But yeah, so we're going to the world title match first because why wouldn't the world title not main event the card, right? So it's Flair and Savage for the world title in a steel cage. And right off the get-go, this might be a hot take, I don't know, but God, I hate Michael Buffer and his announcing for these cards. He drove me crazy with his 14-minute long entrances and stuff like that.
It was bad because he didn't know wrestling. He took the paycheck. Yeah. For boxing, it was perfect. I grew up in a boxing family. Like, we used to, as much as I had the illegal box, we would go to my grandfather's house to watch boxing pay-per-views. I don't know if he did or paid for them. He probably had one too. But Buffer doing boxing was awesome. So when I saw him on wrestling, I was like, yes, this is Buffer. So I liked him as a kid. But going back and watching him, realizing the fact that he has no clue how to announce wrestling, doesn't know the cadence in how to, like, you know, he'll put the emphasis on man instead of macho. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, it's just, he doesn't know wrestling. It's tough.
I agree. And I think of how much money they spent on him and where that could have been used on so many other contracts, you know, for guys that they let go. Right. But yeah, so we get the match. I mean, this is just a weird dynamic to this match. I mean, right off the get go, you have Flair decking the ref for no reason, knocking him out, but there's no disqualification because it's a cage match. You had Savage doing this crazy double axe handle spot off the top of the cage, which probably could have blew his knees out. I'm shocked that he didn't have that happen. I mean, Savage is like 45 years old here or something like this. So, I mean, I wouldn't be doing that right now, I'll tell you that. You know, you had Savage, I love Savage, man. He sells great. And at this time period in his career, he's selling a lot. He's making guys look good. I loved how he sold getting thrown into the cage. He hits the cage face first and just rests on the top rope like he's out cold and just falls off the top rope. You know, that I thought that was cool. Just a little nuance there. And then, you know, other things like Savage puts the figure four on Flair. The Flair goes for the ropes. They don't do a rope break because it's a steel cage match. But then Flair's got the figure four on Savage, and Savage gets the ropes, and the referee pulls Flair off. I'm like, what's going on here? Like, what's the deal? So before we get into the ending of this, what were your thoughts on this match overall from the cage match? And by the way, too much of Flair's ass.
Which, and bravo for not showing anything, right? Like, it was close. Something's got to fall out there, and it just never did. So, I mean, I agree with you, but I was also like, there's nothing else coming out, right? I honestly, and as much as I talk shit on Flair, like, I thought this match was really clean from the in-ring work goes. Storyline was clunky as fuck.
Yes,
but the wrestling itself was really clean, super polished. But then when you hear the stories about Macho Man, is that he'll take the legal pad out and he'll do everything, every single step of the match. So I can see how, you know, his matches would be this this clean. So I loved how clean it was. I loved the Liz part of it because I didn't know the story going into it. I hated the finish. So or the afterwards, I should say. So, but other than that, no, I thought the in-ring work itself was really clean. I always hate when clean matches, clean work doesn't end in a clean way.
Well, this is a perfect example, and you brought this up earlier. The boys did everything right in this match. Everything else screwed things up. You had the referee just kind of forgetting about the rules of this match and screwing that up. You had woman got caught on camera saying, watch out for the gimmick, you know, as she's pulling out the powder to throw at Savage. So that's on the camera, guys. No different than today when we complain about AEW catching every blade job on camera. That's not the wrestler. It's the camera guy. Get off of that shot, right? You know what's coming. And then, of course, you have the ending with Liz with the shoe of doom that comes off, the high heel shoe that Flair ends up hitting Savage with, and he gets the pin. He wins his 13th world championship. And that was a weak ending for a cage match.
Yeah, and they tried to make it cohesive with Hogan by saying he got hit in the eye with the heel and forcing the Hogan aspect after that with him coming down to be the savior of this situation. You're right, man. They did their job, and the production value all around them didn't.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, of as far as in-ring work goes, best one of the night so far.
Yeah. I mean, you got two outstanding veterans that are doing it. They just could have done something different with that. I mean, I know the story was to get Liz to be a heel now, and it worked that way. But Savage is a guy that was not afraid to take a pin. So they could have worked a better angle with that. What's your thoughts? So we had two different styles of cage matches. Which do you prefer? Do you prefer the pinfall in the cage or the escape from the cage?
I actually like the combination. I don't mind a fall count inside or the escape. So like because that's what WWE does now, right? They'll do it's pinfall submission inside or escape through the door over the top. So but the rope breaks, I'm kind of iffy on. I don't know. Yeah. I just like the rules to make sense, you know, but it's like people saying that, you know, why would they get outside Hell in a Cell? It's meant to keep people in. Well, the very first Hell in a Cell, they took the door off. You know what I mean? Yeah. So, like, you know, what are the rules? So, I just, to answer the question, I want the rules to make sense. So, if the rope break stuff wasn't clunky, I'd be okay with that. And if in the next match, if there's no ref on the inside of the cage and it's all about escape, like, then I'm okay with that. The rules just have to make sense. That's all.
Yep. I hear you there. All right. So, yeah, of course, we did get Hogan come down to make the save. And magically, he's able to get backstage for another interview with Mean Gene. So, I don't know if you ever listened to the podcast, Greetings from Allentown. Fantastic podcast. A couple of guys from the Boston area that do one. They basically look back on old school WWF for the most part. Like, we're talking like random stuff, like superstars from January 14th of 1988, right? And they do a 2-hour podcast, and it's just comedy the whole way through. They're just cracking up on everything. But they always do a Hogan counter. They always have a bet on Hogan on all of his promos if he's going to say man, dude, or brother, in which he's going to say the most. So, and they have a theory that because it's always either brother or man that wins in this. Dude doesn't seem to win, but they seem to remember that he used to say dude a lot, but what happened? But they come up with the theory that it's pre the Ninja Turtles movie, and that's when dude really started to become a popular saying. And I realized in this promo from 96, he says dude a ton of times.
That's funny.
And I'm like, okay, maybe it's true. Maybe it is. Once he saw the Ninja Turtles, like, all right, dude's a cool word. We're going to go with that. Or maybe it was Full House, you know, the whole, you know, what's her name? Mary-Kate Michelle. Olsen or whatever.
Yeah.
But anyways, man, dude, brother is always a funny countdown there.
That's awesome.
But yeah, I've never been on the show. I don't even know if they know I exist, but I love their podcast. So I don't miss it. So greetings from Allentown. Go check it out. It's a great show. But yeah. So we got the typical Hogan promo. He's intense. He's man, dude, brother, all that stuff. And he works off Gene. They're both classic together, but again, the Hogan act is getting stale at this point, but we're not long for a little bit of a shakeup in that one. But we're going to Hulk versus the Giant in the steel cage match. I can't believe it. They're still selling the Giant as Andre's son because Hina makes a reference to this. Again, we got Michael Buffer, so I guess that's a $2 million payday that night for him because I think he gets $1 million per announcement. And again, I my first thing was, why is this match escape from the cage if the other match was pinfall in that situation? But it's a Hogan match. You got to have the drama of that.
And he ruins it. He ruins it by entering the cage.
Yes.
From the outside over the top.
Yeah, that was interesting. Yeah. Interesting stuff. And again, I don't know if your memory is too fresh in this, but I mean, Hogan's just been entwined with this whole Dungeon of Doom thing for so long. And it's just, they're just fodder for Hogan. Like, it's just, he's just, as I say, FOH, Friends of Hogan. And you got a bunch of Friends of Hogan there just lining up to take the three punches, the boot, and the leg drop. And again, I always say this, I was a Hulkamaniac growing up, so I loved Hogan back in the 80s, but this just felt, especially looking back on now, it just felt like, wow, man, this is way too old for this time period compared to what we're seeing like with a Bret Hart or a Shawn Michaels or a Diesel or those guys. Thoughts on Hogan at this point?
Yeah, I think as far as a Hogan fan goes, I was definitely there as a kid. Yep. Hogan, Macho Man, Warrior, those were my guys. So like I said earlier, if they weren't on WWF and I got to see them on WCW, I was okay with that. Mm-hmm. So I didn't like the things around them. You know, like I said, I'm not digging Flair. I'm not digging Dungeon of Doom. Yeah. When can my guys do something good? Can they do something fun? So I think that's where I was at that time. Even now, looking back on it, it's almost embarrassing to watch how they treated, not how they treated Hogan, but how they showed Hogan being treated. You know, so like you said, like it's a little too long in the tooth to do. Like, give Hogan the respect that he earned, sure, mm-hmm. but to present it this way as if we still can give you that, yeah, it was probably an understatement.
Yeah, or, for sure.
Or an overpresentation, yeah.
Yeah. So this match, I call it a typical Hogan match, especially against the big man. You know, he gets beat up by the Giant for a little while. He makes the comeback. Looks like he's going to get the body slam. He ends up getting chopped down by Giant before he can do that. Giant with some impressive stuff. He's always been an impressive athlete, especially at this young age. You get a point to the match where you have Hogan hit the three leg drops and you think it's over as he's climbing the cage, and Giant no-sells it, basically just pops up, chases Hogan down. You get that cool chop exchange at the top of the cage, which I did enjoy that because it looked pretty stiff with the two of them. It sounded great. And then finally Hogan knocks him down at the cage, scales over, gets the win in typical Hogan style. And then you have the Taskmaster hitting him with a chair, which again is a no-sell by Hogan. Chases Taskmaster into the ring. And this is where it all breaks down. So before we talk about this breakdown, thoughts on the match itself?
So my original notes were that it was a gratuitous fight to get to the Dungeon of Doom. There was some cool stuff in there. Mm-hmm. I feel bad for the Giant, but I don't, because I listened to Paul White do interviews and he said that he didn't give it his all when he was young. He just thought he can get by on talent. But you see how unpolished he is. If he just did the work, man,
Yeah.
Like that size, that athleticism, that ability, if he stayed trim, you know, like someone like Kevin Nash, right? His body size never changed. He always worked on that. If Giant was able to do that, I mean, there's no limit to how good he could have been. And he always showed that. So that was my original notes. Mm-hmm. Then, like I said, I rewatched it today. And as I'm watching it, I forget what match it was. My son goes, can we watch something with Hulk Hogan? I said, well, sure. I'll just fast forward it. We get to the Hogan match. Why's his eye? Oh, well, his eye, this, that, right? Well, that gets ripped off, and I guess his eye doesn't matter anymore. Okay. Yeah. Within 30 seconds of the match starting, my son goes, oh, I don't like Hogan. He's bad.
He
picked up exactly what Bobby the Brain Heenan has been saying about him for years. He's raking eyes. He's biting faces. He's scratching backs. He goes, oh, like he's a bad guy. I said, that's not a terrible wrestling take. Like he is. Yeah. He just, you know, he's like, well, I don't want to watch this anymore. So I didn't rewatch the match for a second time. But it's tough, man. And that's what I think to your point about, you know, how he was presented to us. I know he was going with the black on his tights for a while. Was that before this? Because I was listening to your show a couple episodes ago. Yeah. So the fact that they went back to red and black during this one, I was a little confused because I was listening to the show and I thought that's where they were skewing was him being a little bit darker. But the, like you said, the red and yellow, it's like, well, no. So it's a big miss there. And then, I mean, you brought it up, the chair shots. Hogan's chair shots were weak. The chair shot to him was weak. And here's my biggest takeaway from the pay-per-view period. Macho Man is fighting Ric Flair. There's two women on the outside, no offense. He gets hit in the eye or the face with a heel, and he needs Hogan to save him.
Yep.
Hogan needs one chair to fight off, 5,000 pounds of men, and they don't want to touch him? So stronger. Yeah, he's stronger than eight men all by himself, and Macho Man can't handle one guy and two women without Hogan's help. That's the kind of shit where when Bruce Pritchard was saying about Vince McMahon ending the show with Hogan, well, Hogan must pose. This is the biggest Hogan must pose of all time. He has to save Macho Man Randy Savage. He has to save him from a guy and two women. Oh, and beat up eight guys by himself. Shouts to Kyle. He'd love that one.
Freudian slip, as we call it.
Just for Kyle, Hogan beat off eight guys at the end of the match all by himself. You know?
I agree. I literally wrote Hogan must pose, right? Because that's what this was. Exact same take I had on. It's like, you now just made Savage look weak. Savage was immobile from a high heel shoe. Hogan has to come in. Hogan wins this match, beats the Giant clean as a whistle, and then he fights off eight guys with a chair with the weakest chair shots. And we're not just talking about eight guys. We're talking about Meng and the Barbarian and One Man Gang and you know, all these
Shark.
Big Shark. Yeah, all these big dudes. And not only that, he drops the chair at one point and starts throwing guys in the cage. So any one of those guys could have grabbed the chair, just waffled them, as Bobby Heenan would say. And they don't. They just all scatter. And then we have Loch Ness coming down, and he wants to go at Hogan, and they won't let him in the cage for some reason. It's like, why not? Let him get in the cage. Let's see what happens. Maybe nine guys.
600 pounds. They kept saying he was 600 pounds. He's the Loch Ness monster. And Taskmaster went to go find him. This is it. You have the Giant. You have Loch Ness. You have Shark. Yeah. You have Barbarian. Like you said, like, Meng, they were all there. And nothing? This is your opportunity. Not only that, you have Hogan in a cage.
Yeah.
And the whole dungeon's down here. It was bad. It was bad.
You wonder why the dungeon didn't work. Well, that's exactly it. You have one guy that's fending them off. And then posing while they're still trying to hold Loch Ness out of the ring. It's just ridiculous. Right. And it gets worse. Trust me. It gets worse. It does. And this is why the fans turned and they needed to turn Hogan heel. But yeah, I agree. Hogan was wrestling like a heel on the next episode of Nitro, the night after he fights Arn Anderson. And I mean, he's the heel the entire match, the stuff that he's doing in the match. I felt sorry for Arn. Like, I'm cheering for Arn just because, you know, who's the bad guy in this match, right?
Right.
And I mean, I know they're going with the same angle. Like, as Flair's gone off the deep end because of Hogan, Hogan's gone to the bad side because of Flair and all this stuff. But no, it's just your son was spot on. He looks like the bad guy. You know, that's That's right. But yeah, it's overall on this show, I'm you know, not feeling good about it. I mean, there's a couple of bright moments, some good in-ring action with a couple of things. I mean, you know, DDP was great. You know, Conan looked good. Savage and Flair until the ending looked good. But other than that, I mean, this is not a great show.
Yeah, and I think I'm feeling so left out, you know, when it comes to the main events, that if you're tuning into Nitro the next night, you want to see what happens with DDP. You want to see what happens with Sting and Luger, and maybe you get a chance to see Conan again. Other than that, like, I'm good on watching my guys. So like I said, that, you know, back then, if I'm tuning in WCW to see Hogan and Macho Man, well, now I got to watch my other guys. Okay, I saw them. I'm going back to Raw now, and I'm going to check that out.
Yeah, for sure. And that's going to be, thankfully, a bit of a palate cleanser compared to this, because we're seeing a whole different side thing. Just a quick note, the episode after on Nitro, Savage comes out to in the opening match, no cell in the eye. Like, there's no patch on his eye, nothing. He's just into it. Hogan, again, he has a patch back on the eye, although it seemed pretty fine when it got ripped off in this match. You did see Conan. Conan ended up fighting a young Devin Storm, who we know as Crowbar. So that was interesting. And yeah, so you saw a couple of guys following up, but it was disappointing, even the episode after. And they ran unopposed because WWF was on break for the Westminster Kennel show or whatever. Oh. So they could have just put a banger of a show out there, and it just turned into... The only good thing is we got Arn Anderson against Hulk Hogan, which we had never seen before, and Arn actually beats him, but the shoe comes into play once again in this match. But yeah, interesting stuff. Interesting stuff. But I apologize for putting you through this one, man. That's right. I really do. So to make up for it, I'm going to tell you to promote where people can get you again so that we can try to get some people to listen to your podcast. All right.
Yes, there's 100+ backlogged episodes of all kinds of up-to-date stuff. I shit on CM Punk. I shit on the Young Bucks. I have an all-out on AEW episode when Matt Hardy got, you know, his brains blown open during a, you know, and I go in, I have so much content of Terrible Wrestling Takes out there that not a lot of it's evergreen. Some of it is, but take a listen on all audio platforms, Terrible Wrestling Takes. Go to TWTakesPodcast.com. I have the links to the platforms there. And at TWTakesPodcast on Twitter. BC, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
No problem. And if you're listening to this podcast, congratulations. You know where to find us because you have found us. So, but if you want to interact with me, you know, send me an email at bchunterwwtt@gmail.com. Let us know your thoughts on this pay-per-view that we're talking about. Do you think that we're being a little bit too rough on it? Do you have some better memories of it? Did you check it out yourself? Let us know. If you want to interact on social media, it's at WWTTpod on Instagram and Twitter. We have a Facebook page, Wrestling with the Truth, on Facebook. And check out the YouTube channels, Wrestling with the Truth, as well as my other YouTube channel, Wrestling with the 80s, where I'm focusing on old school 80s wrestling. If you like that stuff, head on over and subscribe. On that note, I do this every show, but we're running out of time, so I gotta say thanks a lot, Bishop. See you next week.